Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. David Blight won the Pulitzer Prize for his magnificent biography of Frederick Douglass. He looks across America today, and he sees demonstrators pushing down a similar path, the hard path, from protest to change. So this hour on Point, we're going to talk about the lessons history has to teach us about this critical moment in America's democracy and its unfinished work on civil rights. And David Blight joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. He is a professor of history at Yale University and director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition, author of many, many books, including Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, which won the Pulitzer Prize for History last year. David Blight, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. Good to be back with you.
Well, first of all, let's lean quite heavily on your scholarship of Frederick Douglass for a little while. Do you see echoes? Do you hear echoes of Douglass on American streets today?
Oh, yes, I do. Especially since in the 1850s, when Douglass began to learn politics as an abolitionist, as a radical abolitionist, he was an outsider. Very much outside of political parties, outside of any kind of governmental circles. And he went through a process throughout the 1850s, that pivotal decade that led to the Civil War. He went through a process of learning what politics really was about. He never found it easy. He always wanted more, much more, morally, especially out of the Republican Party, for example, the original Republican Party. But he began to learn that if you didn't harness politics, if you couldn't attack slavery at its power base in the government, that it could never probably be destroyed. So there's a huge learning process going on now, collectively, massively across these protests. I can't for a moment know exactly what many young people are experiencing and learning and beginning to know. But if we are experiencing a new movement, which is what everyone seems to be saying, it's going to have to take this path from rage, anger, tremendous moral outrage, and get somehow harnessed into political action, right, into mobilization. Right. And well, into real politics.
So, Professor, if I may ask you, can you tell us more then about that transformation that you're talking about, that Douglass underwent? Because, you know, of course, he was lit by the fire of this righteous moral outrage produced by the institution of slavery. But I hear you saying that he had to go through this process to learn how to embrace a form of pragmatism in order to take meaningful steps to achieve that more moral future. I mean, that seems to be, in the moment, it might be a hard compromise to be willing to make.
Oh, it is. And that's not a word, pragmatism, that a lot of young activists want to hear. And I don't blame them. But what is true, I think, through history, is that nothing ever comes about or really changes just because it's right or just because it obviously may have the moral high ground. Nothing ever changes just because it's on the right side of history or something. It changes only because people manage to mobilize around an issue and mobilize into real politics. If this is happening within some kind of democracy or republic, and this assumes, of course, that we can still preserve this democracy and this republic, But great change has always come in American history when rage gets mobilized somehow into politics. And also it comes, and this is frankly one lesson of history I always stand by. It happens in response to events. big events that no one quite anticipates. And, you know, we can just think about some major examples. The late 1850s brought about some events, from John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry to the election of Lincoln in 1860 to the secession of the South, all within 2 years. Even though this had been coming for decades, Americans suddenly found themselves in civil war. Well, look ahead to the 20th century. The Birmingham events of 1963, Bull Connor's dogs, the televised brutality toward the civil rights activist led directly to the March on Washington and then to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. All of that happened within 1 year. Hmm. Of course, that had a long history, too, leading up to it. Think about the Ferguson example, which is only just 5-6 years ago. The killing of Michael Brown and his body on the streets led to mass protests, led to some police violence, led to lots of rioting. But it, too, led to a consent decree against that city. Attorney General Holder moved in, had a full investigation of that city, and out of it came many of the provisions, or at least the suggestion of many of the provisions, that just ended up in yesterday's major piece of legislation that came out of the U.S. House of Representatives. And here we are again, an event that no one could quite predict, even though there's so many cases of police violence and the killing of Black men that happened before this. No one could have predicted that that type of killing in Minneapolis would spawn this kind of now worldwide protest. Right. And overnight, the mobilization of legislation, even coming out of the House of Representatives, frankly, faster than than legislation ever happened. So history is full of these moments that cannot be ever fully predicted, where the shock of events forces people to reorient themselves in relation to that event. And then it begins to cause ferment with politics and ferment within institutions.
Well, Professor, if I may, absolutely, the arc bends, but it bends slowly, for sure. But in each of the examples that you gave, the heartache that followed the punctuated moment of accelerated history around civil rights, right, human rights in America, we can't hang that on failed efforts of protesters or radicals or demonstrators, right? We have to hang that on the politicians and the leaders and the systems that failed to embrace the very recommendations for change that were made or even passed into law.
Oh, you're completely right. And we can hang it also on the lack over time of enforcement of sometimes the very enactments that events bring about. Take the three great constitutional amendments that came out of Reconstruction, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, ending slavery, bringing about equality before law, and then the Voting Rights Act or amendment. Now, those amendments actually brought about a second founding of the U.S. Constitution. Now, this is a sort of consensus interpretation now among historians and legal scholars, but its enforcement is a whole different story. In fact, it's the lack of enforcement, it's the lack of a rigorous interpretation of the 14th Amendment over the ensuing decades that brought about Jim Crow and brought about segregation, brought about the possibilities of decades of lynchings that went almost entirely unpunished. So, yeah, and the same is true now, we can say, of the great enactments of the 60s. And we should make no mistake, the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 64 Voting Rights Acts were huge. They were extremely important turns in American law, in American society, in American jurisprudence. But that, too, of course, stimulated, as great change always does, a reaction. Mm-hmm. And we're living that reaction again, especially in the wake of such things as the Supreme Court decision of 2013 in Shelby v. Holder, right, which turned around, the Voting Rights Act, and many, many other forms of reaction that have been going on from the American right now for a very long time.
Well, can we just circle back to Douglass here for a moment, Professor Blight, because I really want to understand more this the lessons from the hard road between activism and change. You quote a speech that Douglass gave in 1851 in Syracuse, where he said, "I do believe that two or three dead slaveholders will make this law a dead letter." What was he talking about then?
Well, that's in the wake of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which had federalized the story of how fugitive slaves would be returned to their owners, and it had made it a felony to even participate in the harboring in any way of a fugitive slave. And it struck absolute terror into thousands of free blacks, many of them former fugitive slaves, living in the North. In fact, over the next 6 to 8 years, we estimate that at least 20,000 of them emigrated to Canada. At that point, abolitionists like Douglass, who was still a young man, who was coming out of this period of his life when he tended to be a moral suasionist, believing that really what you had to do is change hearts and minds and not law and politics. He is undergoing at that point, like a lot of young people are today, this idea that, you know what, working within the law and working just on the hearts and minds of the people isn't working. And he begins then to shoulder up to the possible uses of violence, the possible uses of organized violence against slavery. Now, he never had any kind of grand theory about how slave insurrections could be organized or anything like that. But it is a measure, whether it's from the early 1850s or the late 1850s, of how a Douglass, a radical abolitionist, had become desperate. Desperate at the available options to fight slavery. And I can see that, you know, we see versions of that. It's never identical. Historical analogies are always loose. But you can see versions of that now, and how much people are just fed up with countless police killings and seemingly no real national broad response that stops them. So it puts people on the brink of considering doing things that they might not otherwise do.
Well, David Blight, stand by for just a moment, because we are looking at the lessons of history and, as David Blight calls it, the torturous relationship between protest and change. We have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about history's lessons about the hard road between protest and change in America, particularly around the issue of civil and human rights, I'll say. I'm joined today by David Blight. He is a professor of history at Yale University and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the phenomenal biography of Frederick Douglass called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. And Professor Blight, if you can just hang on here for a second, I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. And then, quite frankly, I'm just really eager to hear the two of you speak together. Lucas Johnsis joins us now. He's with us from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. He's executive director of the public radio shows On Being's Civil Conversations and Social Healing Project. He was previously international coordinator for the International Fellowship of Reconciliation, a century-old peace-building organization. Lucas Johnsis, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you might start by bringing in your personal experience and what you learned from some of your mentors who were, you know, great Americans, great voices in the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I had the privilege of being mentored by veterans of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, and I should probably begin by saying that Vincent Harding, who was my closest mentor, used to always take issue with the description of the civil rights movement in those words. I mean, he would always prefer to use the expression the black-led freedom struggle or the Southern freedom movement. And I think he did that precisely because of something that, you know, I think Professor Blight just alluded to, just the continuity of struggle and resistance of and by Black people, and from enslavement until the what we call the modern civil rights movement, and into today, and that is a continuous thread of resistance. And sometimes we tell the story in these ways that are kind of truncated, but in doing that, we sort of ignore the small acts that are happening in between, and that's to take nothing from the larger eruptions of mass protests and movements that happen, but it's also to kind of draw our attention to the organizing that happens in between those moments and the brave acts of conscience that happen in between, and so I think of today as not as a separate moment from the uprising that happened in Ferguson 5-6 years ago. I see it as a continuation of what occurred then, and I'm hopeful that we'll emerge from this with broader, deeper restructuring than we could have imagined 5 or 6 years ago.
So tell me more about that. I mean, you are excited about this moment. Does it feel palpably, even though it's on that same continuum that both you and David Blight have talked about, does it feel palpably different?
Well, I mean, it does in terms of the level of involvement and participation that we see in the scale of participation. Everything from this is the first time we've seen such large scale demonstration across so many cities since King's assassination in 68. And so, I mean, that has to mean something, that has to amount to something. And I think the responses of political leadership to this moment certainly indicate that this is a new opportunity. I think the solidarity protests in London and Berlin and Amsterdam and other cities around the world illustrate that point as well.
Mm. Well, so can you tell me more about, again, lessons to be learned from, I'm just going to use the phrase because it's what's commonly referred to as the civil rights movement, yeah. because what I'm trying to understand here, and I'll have David Blight reflect on this as well, is in the immediate moment of the surge of activism and protest and public conversation about wrongs that must be righted, one of the next things that happens, one of the next steps is people try to offer solutions. And it can be a little piecemeal at times. But of course, the challenge that we're fundamentally talking about is a sweeping systemic one. It's about who we are collectively as Americans. Is there something about how to navigate through that piecemeal approach that we need to be thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for us to remember that, you know, I think King and others, I mean, one of the things they talked about was trying to change the soul of America. And I think it's important to talk about and to understand the deep extent to which we have to change our orientation as a country, and we have to change our sense of ourselves if we're going to really affect the level of change that's needed. And I think that this is a moment of conscience. It's a moment for people to ask themselves. I think the pandemic created one of those moments of conscience where we started to think about and question the way we structure our healthcare in the United States. And I think this is another opportunity for us to ask, like, how do we think about how our policing relates to how we think of ourselves as a community, as a neighborhood, as a city, as a state. I think that has to be a moment of deep reflection, and I think that has to coincide with that. I mean, that awakening of conscience is what leads to the type of structural reforms that we need and that we want to see. I think the problem or the challenge right now is that I think that a lot of folks are understandably impatient with the piecemeal approach that we've lived with, that has sort of gotten us here today. I think that a lot of younger folks have been told many times that we have to make compromises in order to achieve certain ends. And the question about the compromises is that who do you sacrifice in that compromise? And I think that the onus is not on the folks in the streets protesting for, you know, for our lives as Black people in the country to accept a kind of piecemeal approach to our safety and our mm-hmm. security. Mm-hmm. And I think the push and the tension is reflected in what we're experiencing between political leadership at times and demonstration.
So David Blight, come back in here and please, the two of you, feel free to talk with each other. Don't wait for me if you have something that you want to say, because I want to hear all of us in conversation here. But David, if I may, just reflect on what Lucas says about that question of who do you sacrifice in that compromise. This is a question that's come up over and over and over again in America.
Yes, indeed. First of all, if I may, Lucas, I share your inspiration from Vincent Harding. I did not study with him, but I had the great privilege of being on panels with him two or three times. I read his theology and his history, especially the book "There Is a River." and what a writer!
Yeah.
But anyway, and I still recommend people read that. It's an unusual kind of history. But at any rate, yeah, I mean, you really put your finger on here the importance of the scale of this response. I do not think there is necessarily a comparison, except 68, I suppose, at the kind of international response this has received. It's beginning to tell us something, I think, about what the world thinks of us. Not only does so much of the world, and you must know that by living abroad, not only does much of the world sort of enjoy this irony about America's moral righteousness, and then suddenly we're revealed for this terrible underbelly of our history, but also the world is maybe saying that they need us, that they still want America, that they still want America to live up to some of these creeds. And also always this process of outrage to the shock of events and protest, it's always messy. It's always chaotic. It's always going to go through this process, Meghna, that does seem sometimes, you know, piecemeal. People shout things, you know, abolish this, destroy that. But one of the things that gives me hope out of this, and we're only at the beginning of this, let's face it, is that we are experiencing a massive outpouring of demand for the public sector in this country. Mm. That is use of federal authority, federal power, federal oversight, national standards. It's all over the new legislation from the House. National standards about police behavior, national standards about collecting data, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this is so important and sometimes lost in our debates right now. We have, since Reaganism, lived through a constant assault on the idea of the public sector, public schools, public transportation, public infrastructure, environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And ever since the pandemic hit, frankly, before these protests, Americans are suddenly begging for the government to come summon somehow and first educate them about this pandemic, and then secondly, save them. Hmm. Well, we could be undergoing here one of those historical turns. I'm not predicting anything here, but we could be undergoing one of those historical turns again, not unlike the late 1960s and all that flowed from the Great Society, both good and bad, and not unlike the great transformations of Reconstruction, where it was only the public sector that could remake us out of our own chaos, out of our own struggles with ourselves.
Well, David, if I may, this is really provocative. And I would also say at the same time, it's the failures of that same public sector which have contributed to the unending subjugation of rights of Black Americans. I mean, it's the same public sector that gave rise to mass incarceration in the United States. So to turn back to this sense of impatience that people feel now, and perhaps wondering if they can turn to the public sector to be a source of the solution, and not having a clear answer to that, I don't blame them.
No, I agree with you. And what's more public sector than a police department?
Right.
They're completely funded by our tax dollars. Private foundations don't have to support police departments, but private foundations are all over schools, you know, to try to save them. But all I'm trying to suggest is, yes, this is in some ways always been the case, that we sometimes need the public sector to be redefined, reinvigorated, maybe even revolutionized, in order to help us get out of a mess that in part the public sector helped create. But I still wouldn't give up on my argument that we've had a sustained political attack on that which might be deemed public sector now for 40 years, even longer, in our politics. And it is there right now in the beginnings of this debate, which are only 24 hours old, over this new legislation that was just introduced yesterday by the House of Representatives. Right. What do the Republicans do? Rather than answering the 10 or 12 features of that legislation, they immediately go to the demand out on the streets to defund police. They don't even answer what's in that bill. They just go to the useful political line about defunding police is not the answer.
Right. Well, I mean, I would say there are also several Democrats that are concerned about the language that's being used around these kinds of pieces of legislation, including Jim Clyburn, who says, let's not talk about defunding. Let's talk about other aspects of change that can happen. But now, Lucas, about how we talk about this moment, I really would love to hear. I mean, to David's point, people's attention can be focused in certain directions given how we talk about these issues. Just your thoughts on that. And David's exactly right. We've had debate that's just popped up over one piece of legislation in 24 hours that's already serving to divide.
Well, that's true. And I think that if you listen to many of the activists that are a part of the movement for Black Lives, like this legislation isn't satisfactory. And I think that what it speaks to and what that fact speaks to is just that this is really a moment of reimagining. And David, I agree with your analysis about, you know, what the Reagan years did in terms of our relationship to the public sector. And we also, this is not, you know, the goal for us can't be to return to what was, right? We have to really open up space within ourselves and within our public imagination for something else, something new, something that many of us have never seen before in the United States. Or if we saw it, we didn't recognize it to be something that we could actually treat as our norm, so to speak. And I think that as much as the attention gets directed towards, some of let's say, more radical revolutionary language of abolition or and whatnot, I think that we should really pay attention to the creativity and the imagination that's within that language, and the imagination that's also being articulated, which is not as likely to catch the headlines because that's not, that's not as newsworthy for whatever reason.
Yeah. Well, if I could just, I agree with you. I have a feeling we're going to agree on almost everything, but yes, this could be, if sustained, and especially in an election season like what we're about to experience, this could be a real transformation in moral imagination. There are a lot of Americans now responding to this that 2 weeks ago weren't even thinking about it. Right. People from the suburbs who are coming into cities and walking in marches. And, we can say whatever we want about that. How authentic is it? And so on and so forth. But by God, they're there. And that's the first time in their lives they've ever gone to something called a protest march. There may be something happening in moral imagination. And it took this horrible visual phenomenon, of a torture murder, which is really what it was. That's what lynching was. Yeah. It was torture murders. We all got to watch a lynching. Mm. And as for legislation, we may have to come back to this.
Professor Blight, why don't we do that? Because we got to take a quick break here. We are talking this hour with David Blight and Lucas Johnson about lessons from history on that hard path between protest and change. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we're going to be circling back with one of America's leading public health experts, and we'll be talking about the latest in what we know about the novel coronavirus pandemic and your questions about what next as the country continues to attempt to reopen in the midst of this multi-historic time. So give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. About where we are in the coronavirus pandemic. That's tomorrow's show. Today, we are having a remarkable conversation with two thinkers about the hard road between protest and change in America and the lessons that history has to teach us about traveling that road. I'm joined today by Lucas Johnson. He's executive director of the public radio show On Being's Civil Conversation and Social Healing Project. He was also previously international coordinator for the International Fellowship of Reconciliation, a century-old peace-building organization. And David Blight joins us as well. He's a professor of history at Yale University and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. And before the break there, David, I think you were talking about the horror that has brought people into the streets who may never have been before, and what happens next. You were building towards a point that our break had to interrupt. I'm sorry about that.
That's quite all right. But I'd actually like to make a point about this idea of healing and then turn it right over to Lucas, because he's done so much work on this huge idea. I wrote this book about 18, 19 years ago called Race and Reunion, about the memory of the Civil War. And the central theme of that book was how Americans, for the 50 years after the end of slavery and the end of the Civil War, they had this terrible dilemma over healing versus justice. I mean, the country had to find a way to heal. It had to find some new levels of justice. But it became this tortured relationship between these two, you know, huge, profound ideas. Whose healing would it be? Whose justice would it be? And in the long run, you know, to boil it all down, most of the healing was experienced by ex-soldiers if they and their families, if they could, and by white Southerners. And most of the justice, if you will, was experienced largely by ex-Confederates and the white South as they regained complete control of their societies. This tortured relationship between healing and justice is still with us. It's still the unresolved, unfinished problem out of the Civil War and Reconstruction. We live the legacies of Reconstruction every day in our lives. Healing always has to somehow be balanced with justice. You can't have one without the other. That's this sort of tortured part of our history and also really of the human condition. But we have to find a way to do both. I really wonder what Lucas thinks on that.
I mean, as seems to be the trend, I agree with you. I think that, I mean, there are so many, you know, I mean, if you look at U.S. history, I mean, there's so much violence and there are so many festering wounds that we are constantly contending with. And I think that, you know, in order for us to, you know, part of the process for us to arrive at the country we want to be, the country we aspire to be, part of that process has to include some space for healing, for truth telling, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there are so many people carrying around, you know, I think about how many people who were complicit in lynchings that are still around today and who are carrying that memory and that knowledge in their bodies. Right. And if not them, they're carrying the story that their grandfather told them or that their father told them. And they've never really allowed themselves the vulnerability to tell the truth about that experience. Right. I there's so much layer upon layer upon layer of festering pain and some of it self-inflicted, because of our unwillingness to be vulnerable and to tell the truth and to remain complicit in lies that have disoriented our sense of ourselves and our relationship to each other, and I think that's got to be a part of all of this, and that's got to be a part of the moral awakening that we need to occur for us to move forward as a country.
But Lucas, can I just jump in here for a second, because I'm just thinking still about what David was saying, that in eras past, the healing has been for whites, and in fact, that's basically exactly what you said, David. Right? Much of it post Civil War. I mean, should we make a distinction this time around, Lucas? That we have to create space specifically for the healing for Black Americans.
Well, so yes, and David, I think that I heard you. I thought you were being a little bit provocative there, because with that use of language, because I don't think that the healing that you were describing was actually healing, and I don't think that the justice that you were describing was actually justice.
Right? No, that's unfinished, badly unfinished healing and justice.
Right. Right, and to your point, Meghna, absolutely. I think that for Black Americans, you know, who have been walking with the legacy of that harm, and who have been For us, you know, to have the country actually acknowledge and recognize the everything that has been done to us, from the, not just from enslavement, but you know, to you know, past Reconstruction to convict leasing to, you know, to all the building of the prison industrial complex to what we're facing now and all the many things in between. For us to have that national acknowledgement, to think about what it means to acknowledge that harm done and to seek repair, and to what it means to repair that harm done, that's a conversation that we've never been able to have, and it would be tremendously beneficial towards our healing as a society as a whole, because you can't heal from this conflict if it's only one side healing.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You also, yeah, and I agree. And if I could say too, you also can't heal in a world of ignorance. Right. You know, I know I'm a historian, and this is always self-serving to say, but my goodness, we've still got a lot of historical education to go on. And on that note, Lucas, you brought it up. I know that this new bill out of the House is not a finished product, and it's not perfectly adequate on this or on that. But I would urge people to actually go read it. I spent a piece of today reading it. And go to the section toward the end, which is the anti-lynching bill, the new attempt at an anti-lynching bill. It's called the Justice for Victims of Lynching Act. And they actually, and they've had this prepared for a long time. They just plugged it in. But it goes through a lot of history. It names the numbers, 4,742 total lynchings over a period of X number decades. It talks about the NAACP being forged around its anti-lynching campaign. It mentions that there have been 200 bills before Congress that have never been passed. It mentions the great new museum in Montgomery about lynching, which has been a place of learning for sure. And who knows about healing? Hard to judge. And anyway, it's an extraordinary bill. And it, of course, it federalizes the crime.
Mm.
And it also provides for restitution to the families of lynching victims, which was in the original anti-lynching bill in 1921. A lot that's in that bill today was in the 1921 bill that got blocked. Wow. By the Democratic Party's Southern bloc. And actually, it needs to be said here, too. This is another one of those, everyone's using that term, inflection moments, whatever you want to call them, turning points, shock of events. There was a national consensus in 1921 for an anti-lynching bill. There really was. And the NAACP ran an amazing campaign of publicity and activism to bring that about. And the Republican Party was on board with it until it quit on it. It was blocked by a filibuster, the first major use of the filibuster by the Southern Democrats at that moment. And it never got voted in the Senate. It passed the House a bunch of times. And it was that turning point that began to turn Black Americans against the Republican Party because they betrayed them. And within a decade, they're going to all be Democrats. But it's remarkable that bill actually today, the new bill introduced yesterday by Karen Bass and the Black Caucus, it just repeats a lot of what's been there for 99 years in this kind of legislation. I think people need to learn that and realize this time, maybe this time, we can't fail at it. We got to make that happen.
Lucas?
That's a powerful argument. I haven't read the bill myself, so I didn't know that.
Well, it just came out.
I appreciate like that. Yeah, you know. That, I mean, that's a powerful argument. And I mean, and the other thing, and the other lessons in history that you just provided also illustrate the extent to which this movement, this momentum, has to actually be, let's say, filibuster proof. Like it has to actually transcend. It has to be bigger and broader and more sweeping than the electoral politics that will come in November. And that's not to dismiss those, and that's not to dismiss the political process. But I'm saying that in order for the change we need to be sustained, it needs to be embraced by, it needs to have a bipartisan embrace. I mean, I don't like that language because I feel like it seems kind of reductionist in a way, because it when you're making moral arguments, but it needs to really be seeped into our bones, into our DNA as Americans, that there is a wrong that needs to be righted if we are going to be healthy as a country.
Mm. You know, David and Lucas, we only have about 4-ish minutes left in this conversation, which, quite frankly, I would like to have for many, many hours with both of you. But I want to try and bring together a couple of threads here that we've been discussing. And one of them is this need for broad, sweeping change about the soul of America, as you've said, Lucas. And David, you just shared with us the sort of Groundhog's Day feel of American history in terms of major attempts to effect that change that have been stopped actually by the political process itself. So the reason why I'm trying to bring these things together is that, I mean, the next stop is on this road is an election, right? And so, David, you wrote about this in your piece a little bit. I'm just wondering if you could just share with us your thoughts about how there is, it's not the be-all and end-all, but there is a necessity to acknowledge the importance of electoral politics in America's history of slowly moving towards the country that we wish to be.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And it's certainly, again, it's another lesson of history. If indeed we cannot harness or mobilize the resistance that's out there in the streets right now, the marching, the outrage, into politics on some level, you have to keep asking, what's the alternative? And usually the alternative is only some kind of revolution. Now, there are many different kinds of revolutions. There can be violent revolutions that end in guillotines, or there can be revolutions that end in transformations of political parties, transformations of legislation, transformations of elections that surprise us. In my essay in The Atlantic, I actually, at the very end, I named about 8 or 9 presidential elections in American history that did indeed transform the country. Some for better and some for worse, but they often do this. And I suggested that maybe we ought to, go read a little bit about that and realize how much an election does matter. I mean, the risk, again, is if you can't harness this into politics, what's the alternative? Where else do you go? And what you risk is this kind of utter alienation and atomization of a movement into all its little fragments, and never coalescing around what it actually takes to change this country, which is political coalition. And coalitions are never easy. They're always discordant. And they're always a question of mutual tolerance. But it's through big coalitions that the world actually gets changed.
Right. Well, Lucas, we have about a minute or so left, and I'm just going to let you have the last thought today.
Yeah, I agree with David. I would only just hope that we can this moment will translate not just to, we need to find a way for this to translate to politics and political action, yes, but not be defined by the current nature of our politics. It needs to, the change and the transformation we need needs to be deeper. For us to emerge as a better country afterwards, I think that's what's needed, and it's not in contradiction to the change that David is describing, but I hope it's in addition to.
Well, Lucas Johnson is executive director of the public radio show On Being's Civil Conversations and Social Healing Project. He was previously international coordinator for the International Fellowship of Reconciliation, a century-old peace-building organization, and he joined us today from Amsterdam. Lucas, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And David Blight, professor of history at Yale University and director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition, and author of many books, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. David Blight, it is such a pleasure to have you back on the show. Thank you as well.
Thank you, Magna. Great to meet you, Lucas.
And I'm going to end today with a quote that David Blight points us to in his piece in The Atlantic. And by the way, that piece is linked at onpointradio.org. It is from Frederick Douglass about how in 1855 he wrote he would continue to do his work as long as he could with his voice, his pen, and his vote. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.